Thank you, Jack, for that introduction. You are a beautiful bunch. My name is John Parr, and I'm powerless over alcohol. Jack mentioned that my story is in the second edition, the 1955 edition of the Big Book. What he didn't tell you was that in the third edition of the Big Book, the 1976 edition, they took my story out. Now, the New York office, I think, thinks it's not very good, or else that I'm dead, which I almost am. You know, there's one disadvantage in having your story in the Big Book. You know, each person in AA has only one story, basically. And that one in the Big Book is mine. And I had delivered that talk word for word in a lot of places, in Alabama, Georgia. But one time I was out in Arkansas. Well, no one had ever heard me, didn't know anything about me. And I was speaking at the Arkansas State Convention in Little Rock. And when I got through, we all met in the city auditorium, and when I got through, we all were milling around out in the lobby. And about a few feet away from me, I heard a fellow saying, "That last speaker was a fake, a liar, and a thief. He stole every word of that right out of a story in the Big Book. I read it last night." That actually happened. Now, maybe you've noticed I didn't say I'm an alcoholic. I said I'm powerless over alcohol. I've come to dislike that word, alcoholic, for this reason. Of all the definitions I know of an alcoholic, hardly any one of them, or several of them, seem to adequately define all the people I know in AA. Now, we are basically all alike, except individually each one of us is a little bit different. Now, you will hear that an alcoholic is this and he is that, or he does this or he does that, or he doesn't do this or he doesn't do that. And all of that sounds rather true, until the exception staggers in the door. And somehow the definitions don't seem to fit him. He's a little bit different. And so I always like to advise a prospective member, not that he's an alcoholic, but for him or her to go off in a corner and all by himself ask the question and answer it himself. Because, you know, in the long run, he's the only one who really knows. Now, I am, and I have been, for almost the past 40 years, a university professor. And I have all of the necessary degrees. Doubtless I got overeducated as that doctor down in Statesboro, Georgia says, he was educated beyond his intelligence. You might think that a man who has 3 college degrees would have had sense enough, intelligence enough not to become a drunk. But here I am. Now, I was born and just down the road in Atlanta, Georgia. And I was raised there, graduated from high school there. And I grew up there a very shy, anxious, fearful, resentful person with a lot of determination. Now, determination is a splendid quality to have. But when I mixed mine with alcohol, the two cut me almost to pieces. Now, some people have trouble with alcohol from the very first drink. I did not. I began as a social drinker in my early 20s, and drinking constituted no problem for me until I was into my 30s, and I had already graduated from graduate school. But then, as the tensions and the anxieties and the fearfulness in my life began to increase, finally I slipped over the line between social and alcoholic drinking. And once having crossed that line, I went down fast, as if I had fallen off a precipice. And then, for a number of years, it looked as if I were going to fill my life and my home with more and more wreckage. It really looked as if I were going to ride what they call the toboggan of destruction to the bitter end. And as some of you know, the bitter end is not a pretty place. Now, I admit that I didn't get as bad as some I have heard. I was one of those that second edition of the big book tells you of one who stopped in time. I never lost a job or quit one to keep from getting fired. I never wrecked a car. I never got a DWI or a DUI, whichever you call it. I never went to one of my classes drinking or drunk. Oh, I've been there awfully hungover. I have never killed anybody. I've never raped anybody. I have never in all my life fallen in love with another man. But I assure you, I did about everything else. And I assure you, I drank enough whiskey to get into much more trouble than I care to admit. You know, there are all kinds of drunks. There are melancholy drunks. There are weeping drunks. There are traveling drunks. There are disappearing drunks. I knew one who could disappear while you were looking right at him. And a number of other varieties. Now, I was a self-centered and occasionally violent drunk. I I began being a college professor, a university professor, at the University of Alabama, where I was on the faculty for 21 years, there in Tuscaloosa. And in 1962, or some 17 years ago, I moved to Northern Ohio, where I joined the faculty as a senior professor at Kent State University. And there, I taught Shakespeare with a Southern accent. I don't think anybody laughs very much anymore at that, since that accent's now coming out of the White House. But I graduated with high honors. I'm a member of Phi Beta Kappa. And I didn't play football. And so the only claim to fame I have at Alabama is that I taught freshman English to Gomer Pyle.
True.
You know, if I had known Jim Neighbors was going to make that much money, I would have sat down and let him teach. Now, while I was at Alabama, I came to believe that life was simply not worth living unless I could drink. And at that time, I was utterly miserable. I was sometimes desperate. I lived always in a state of fearfulness and tension. And to cure such fears, I always tried a little more drinking, with the inevitable result. Because by this time, one drink would set up in me that irresistible and uncontrollable urge to take another one and another one and still another one and another one. Until I was down and out and hung over and usually in some kind of trouble. And in that hangover stage, I would vow to never touch another drop. And yet, being a daily drinker, I was always drunk again that night. Now, I went through that kind of punishment to myself and my family again and again and again and again and again. And so, I had no trouble with that second step that indicates that we can be restored to sanity, because I was crazy. There came a time when I knew that there had to be some changes made. And so I set about to change the time of my drinking. And I tried to change the place of my drinking. And I tried to change the amount of my drinking and my environment. I even entertained the idea of changing wives. Now, you haven't done much drinking if you try that. I didn't, but I had the idea. I tried to change everything and everybody except myself, which I now know is the only thing I can change. Sometimes nowadays I look in the mirror and I am resolved in the conclusion that my wife Mary didn't get such a hell of a bargain either. No. Well, back in those days, I was ignorant of alcoholism. I tried many times to quit on my own and failed every time. I didn't know, in my ignorance of the disease, I didn't know that it was physically impossible for me to drink socially or moderately. I didn't know that my body's drinking machinery had worn out and that the parts could not be repaired or replaced. I didn't know that it was that first drink, just one drink, that made it impossible for me to control my behavior and my future drinking. I always thought it was drink number 17 or number 19 that threw me on my face instead of the first one. In short, I didn't know that I was powerless over alcohol. And I am fairly sure that my family and my close friends knew this about me before I did. Now, finally, as with most of us, and I'm not going through a long drunkalogue to tell you all these things because you know how drunks behave. Finally, as with most of us in AA, there came a crisis. And after a terrific drunken affair in which I became violently insane, I landed in Chief Billingsley's Plaza, commonly known as the Tuscaloosa City Jail. I don't know exactly what happened to me on this, my last bender. But here are some things that did happen to me, which I was told about, at least most of them, subsequently. It was in February, and after breaking up a number of things in my house, and I think throwing the living room lamp at my wife, I was about 11:30 at night. I was running up and down my front and my side yard with my pajamas flapping in the wind, daring all the neighbors to come out and fight. Well, now, there's nothing to do but to lock me up. And then the officers who came out to my house looked things over, and they decided they didn't want to take me in. But I insisted. And that proves you're crazy, right there. I also insisted that they have a seat in the living room while I went back to the bedroom and got into my newest and my nicest suit with socks and tie to match so I'd look nice in jail. Did you ever hear anything more stupid? I don't remember the ride downtown in the squad car, but when I came to out of the fog in the jail corridor, I didn't like the looks of that little cage they were shoving me into, and I took issue about that with three big policemen. And they say I tried to indulge in some fisticuffs with three policemen all at once, each one of them twice my size and armed with a gun and a blackjack. Now I ask you, what kind of thinking and what kind of acting is that? If that isn't insanity, if that isn't some sort of mental illness, what is it? Well, they put me in, all right, but then I yelled so loud and screamed and beat on the bars so that I disturbed all the other guests of the plaza, and they must have complained Because soon a couple of officers came up and unlocked me, and do you know, I was stupid enough to think they were letting me out. They took me downstairs right by the sergeant's desk and on down some more stairs underneath the concrete where they put me in a place called solitary. Fine place, isn't it, for a university professor to spend the night? Now, 2 days later, I was willing to try AA, which I had only vaguely heard about not much more than 2 months before. As I look back, something must have happened to me during those 2 days. Some forces must have been at work which I do not yet understand. But on those 2 days between jail and AA, something happened to me that had never happened to me before. Now, I repeat, I don't know for certain what it was. I thought once that I had merely made a decision, but I discarded that idea in favor of assigning the cause to the guiding hand of God, because I think God gave me a shove into AA. And that was followed by my own attempt to make, the best I could, those 12 steps to recovery. Well, whatever it was that brought me in, I have been in AA, and I have not had a drink since that time. And that time was in February of 1949. So I've been around a while. Now, I would like to tell you one or two things about that Tuscaloosa, Alabama group where I first joined Alcoholics Anonymous. The group was new then. It was 2 years old at that time, and there were only 6 groups in the whole state of Alabama. I checked the directory not so long ago, and I noticed that 135 groups are listed in Alabama today. There were just 6 of them there when I joined in Tuscaloosa. And we didn't know much. AA was new down in most of the Southland at that time. We did have a copy of the big book, and we had one or two little pamphlets that the Birmingham group had supplied us with. And we had made at least the first part of the first step, and then we had latched on to one part of the 12th step, ignoring all the other steps in between. And then we went out and tried to sober up everybody in West Alabama. Now, on meeting nights, we had a little club room in the basement of the courthouse. On meeting nights, nobody drinking dared show his head on the streets of Tuscaloosa, because we would go out and grab him and bring him into the meeting whether he wanted to come or not. And we never sobered up a single one that way, not one. And we did have a telephone in this little club room, and if the phone rang and a drunk called, some of us got in a car and went out to his house, armed with a pint and a bottle of pills. Now, we were real sympathetic, and we wanted to help him make it through the night. And if he weren't drunk when we got there, you can bet he was stoned when we left. And this was all wrong, too. And dangerous. And dangerous. We could have killed somebody. And once we thought we had. We had gone out to Ed's house, and we had fixed him up with a bottle of paraldehyde. Some of you new people, you don't know what paraldehyde is, but that's some stuff that smells all the way near Savannah. But it's powerful. And when about an ounce or two of that hits your stomach, very soon thereafter, you freeze as if rigor mortis has set in. And we had given Ed about 2 or 3 ounces of that stuff. And he had lurched forward in the bed, and just as he had, his false teeth came half out. And he clamped down on them just as he froze, and they were half in and half out. And there he lay. And his wife called us the next day, and she thought we had killed him because she couldn't wake him up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He was still out. Well, we went through several experiences of that sort, learning by our mistakes. And a number of us managed to stay sober. We managed to stay sober because we were out there trying to help somebody else. And that's one of the big secrets in AA. And if you haven't learned it, get on the boat. Because we found that when you get concerned with other people than yourself, it's a lot easier to stay sober. Now, I don't know why it is that to men and women, and I've often wondered why it is why it is they get themselves into such a horrible alcoholic condition. And actually, nobody knows why. Because, you see, the basic cause of alcoholism is still unknown. The very basic cause is still unknown. Now, I suggested, in spite of telling you that, I suggested once that the alcoholic simply does not know what he really wants. Or, he always wants something that he doesn't have. And there's a definition of him that fits this theory rather beautifully. And it goes like this, that an alcoholic is a fellow who, when he's rich, he wants to be poor. And when he's poor, he wants to be rich. And when he's married, he wants to be single. And when he's single, he wants to be married. And when he goes to a wedding, he wants to be the bride. When he goes to the dinner table, he wants to make love. When he goes to bed, he wants some ice cream. He doesn't know what he wants. I know most of you must have heard that story about Christopher Columbus being an alcoholic. And so you know, when Christopher started out, he didn't know where he was going. And when he got there, he didn't know where he was. When he got back home, he didn't know where he had been. And to top it all, he had conned a woman, Queen Isabella, into getting up the money to finance the trip. Typical alcoholic. You know, right recently I haven't been too sure about George Washington. You remember that picture of George crossing the river? Huh? Let me ask you, how many of you, cold sober, would cross the Delaware River standing up in a rowboat? You look carefully at that picture again, and you will notice that on the left side, George's coat bulges out a little bit right here. Just a big enough bulge out of George. Well, now more seriously, I know that nowadays alcoholism is recognized as partly a symptom of some deep-seated maladjustment of the personality. Or it's a symptom of some emotional conflict which a person has been unable to solve. For example, in my case, and I won't go into your case, this is my case. In my case, I am a very self-centered person, egotistical, and quite unreasonable in my demands upon other people, either actually or in my own mind. And secondly, I am emotionally immature. Or at least my emotions have frequently run away with my common sense. By emotional immaturity, I don't mean I'm a baby, but I do mean that emotionally, I'm extremely susceptible to things like resentment, envy, anxiety, fear, grandiose daydreaming, you know, thinking I'm somebody I'm not, and that kind of thing. And then third, I tried hard to be a perfectionist. Now, we may find some perfection in heaven, but we're not going to find it too much on this earth. And when things were not perfect just the way I wanted them, I took more and more to the bottle. And fourthly, I found that I was running away. I was running away from the reality of my personal situation. Now those four things, self-centeredness, emotional immaturity, a striving for perfection and running away from reality, those are the chief personality defects that play havoc with the alcoholic's way of living. And they are hard to get rid of. And I must confess to you, I haven't got completely rid of mine yet. But I have improved. I have improved at least to the extent that I no longer have to take a drink or a pill to cope with those things. And of course now at my age I'm just plain scared to take a drink. There are other detrimental personal characteristics that we have, such as anger, pride, intolerance, self-pity, lust occasionally, and then just being plain stupid. And not many of us can hold on to those personal defects and not go back to drinking. Not many of us can make it. They must be removed, or at least adjusted. Because in our drinking careers now, we were just not very good people. We were not honest. We were not unselfish. In fact, there were some times we weren't even decent. All that must change. That's why the 12 steps are there. That's the reason. The 12 steps are there. And I have found out that they work much better than all of my well thought out ideas. Those 12 steps, too. You know, in AA, the AA practices and procedures have worked very well for a tremendous number of people. And a lot of us get help from a continual association with our groups. We can get a great deal of help by the observations that we can make there in our own groups. It seems that just associating with excessive drinkers who stay sober, just associating with them has some sort of favorable psychological effect upon us. And not only that, but we can benefit also by associating with excessive drinkers who do not stay sober. And that has favorable, benevolent effects upon us too. I've frequently thought that I learned almost as much from the losers as I learned from the winners. Those losers, I watched them, and they taught me some things not to do. Then in our groups, we sit around and we take everybody else's inventory. Now, you don't do that in Cottesville, I know, but they do in almost every group I've ever been in. Which is all right, because when you take everybody else's inventory, eventually there's no one to take but your own. And when you start taking your own, you're on the way. Yes, in our groups, we learn to eliminate alcoholism by improving ourselves. We learn to change our self-centeredness. We learn to stop running away from things we do not like. And we try to remove or at least adjust our personal shortcomings. And we do these things by taking honestly and sincerely, and I'd like to emphasize those two words, by taking honestly and sincerely our 12 steps to recovery, which is the best thing for a cure for alcoholism anybody has discovered yet. Because we know, AA is old enough now, that we know that taking those steps over a sufficient period of time will change our attitude, change our way of thinking, change the inner man or woman into something it had not been before, and change our pattern of living into one we had not enjoyed in the past. Yeah, changing our attitude. I'm going to tell you a little story about attitude. I'm sure my wife doesn't want me to do it, but I don't see very many teenagers around, and I think most of you are adult enough you wouldn't be too offended. And this man weighed 200, great big fellow, weighed 285 pounds. He married a girl, 95 pounds. And they got married, and they went on their honeymoon up to Niagara Falls. And as soon as they got into the hotel room, he turned, locked the door, and he turned around and he said, "Woman, I want you to get one thing straight. I'm the boss in this family. We are going to do things in this family my way. You are not going to wear the pants in this family." And just to prove and illustrate what I'm talking about, I'm going to show you something. I want you to try to put on my pants. And so he took his pants off and he handed them to her. And, of course, she said, yes, dear. And she stepped into his pants. And there was enough room in the waistband to put a couple of pillows in there to and still have plenty of room. And she they came up to her beyond her neck, and she was peeping out of the fly. And he said, you see, you can't wear the pants. And she said, well, now, you try on a pair of mine. And she reached into a suitcase, and she got out this pair of little flimsy, lacy things. And he said, okay, and he got them over his feet and over his ankles, and he got them up about his knees, and that's when he stopped. And he struggled, and he huffed and puffed a few times, and he finally said, honey, I can't get into your pants. And she said, Buster, that's just the way it's going to be from right now on until you change your attitude. But when we get in AA and we change our way of thinking and change our attitude, then it happens, and sometimes I think it happens when we least expect it. We discover that we are reasonably happy people. We are contented, and we are full of thanksgiving. Full of thanksgiving. Now, that's something I once knew or thought I knew I could never be without drinking. I don't know what you think about Martin Luther King, but you know Martin Luther King said one thing that's very applicable to all of us. He said it in a different context, but he said, I am not what I would like to be, and I may not be what I ought to be, but thank God I'm not what I used to be. And that applies to most of us in AA. Thank God we are not what we used to be. AA doesn't function in a way that people normally expect it to. You know, for example, instead of using our willpower, as almost everybody outside of AA thinks we do, we don't. We give up our wills to a higher power. We place our lives in hands, invisible hands, much stronger than ours. And another thing that I ran into a large number of times, they'll say, John, you've been in AA now X number of years. Surely you can take just one drink. You know, it doesn't work that way, does it? It's logical for them to think that, but it doesn't work that way with us. What I'm leading up to is that our program and our procedures are different from normal opinion. And in this connection, I'd like to pass on to you what I consider to be the four paradoxes of how Alcoholics Anonymous works. Now, not why, I don't know why, but how AA works. Now, a paradox, as you may already know, is a statement which is self-contradictory, like wet is dry, up is down. Black is white. That sort of thing. A statement that contradicts itself. But a true paradox is a statement that appears to be false, but in certain instances proves to be true. Now, I haven't time to discuss each of these paradoxes with you, but I'd like to just list them for you to consider. The first one is that we in AA surrender to win. We surrender to win. Now, on the face of it, especially in this war-torn world, surrendering certainly doesn't seem like winning anything. But it is in AA. It is only after we have come to the end of our road. It's only after we have hit a stone wall in some aspect of our lives beyond which we could go no further. It's only when we, usually in despair, we give up, we surrender. It's only then that we can accomplish the sobriety that we could never seem to accomplish before. And so we must, and we do, surrender to win. And the second one is we must give away to keep. I know you've all heard that. We must give away to keep. Well, now that seems absurd and untrue. How is it that you can keep anything if you give it away? Well, in order to keep whatever it is that we get in AA, we must go about giving it away. And giving it away for no fees, no rewards of any kind. What do we give away? The message. That's all. Simple message. And it is so simple, I don't understand people getting misdirected about it. The message is there's a much better way of living than doping ourselves with drink. So in AA, we give away to keep. And the third paradox is that we suffer to get well. We suffer to get well. Now, there is no way to escape the terrible suffering of remorse and regret and shame and embarrassment. Oh, you don't know how embarrassed I was when I walked into my first AA meeting. Shame, embarrassment, say nothing of those hangovers that finally gets us on the right road to being cured of our affliction. Now, there is no new or easy way to shake out a hangover. It is painful. And I don't care whether you do it cold turkey at home or whether you do it strapped down in a hospital bed. It's painful. And for us, necessarily so. Because if we haven't suffered sufficiently, we just don't have it in us to make those 12 steps to recovery. And so, in AA, we suffer to get well. And then the last paradox, number four, is that we have to die to live. We die to live. Now that is a beautiful paradox straight out of the biblical idea of being born again, no matter how corny you think it sounds. Or out of the biblical idea of in losing one's life, one shall find it. Because it seems to me that each one of us has two lives. And when we make at our 12 steps, now nobody makes them perfectly, but when we make at our 12 steps sincerely and honestly, one life of us, the old life of guzzling and fuzzy thinking and all the other that goes with it, gradually dies. And we acquire a newer and a better way of life. As our shortcomings are removed, one life of us dies and another life of us lives. And so in AA we die to live. Now I'm through, except I want to say briefly three things. First, I want to thank Joe and his committee for inviting me to this convention, this roundup in Cartersville, Georgia. Mary and I very much appreciate all the hospitality you've shown us here. And I thank Joe and his committee for asking us to come over. And I thank you in the audience for listening as you have attentively. You know, you're carrying the message by just sitting there, just being there. You're carrying the message. And secondly, and I'm not sure exactly how to say this, but by virtue of my position as a university professor, I have joined a lot of things. I'm a Phi Beta Kappa, and I belong to the American Association of University Professors. I'm a member of the Shakespeare Society of America. I was an international professor to England, to the Shakespeare Institute. I've joined a lot of things. But AA is the best thing I ever joined. And I intend to stay in it all the rest of my days. And lastly, I must say to you that God and AA have been exceptionally good to me. Especially good to me. And I hope that those two, God and AA, will continue to be good to each and every one of you. So God be with you.